Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sam Tannenhaus, who's the editor of the New York Times Book Review and a former editor of the Week in Review section of the Times. From 1999 to 2004, he was a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, where he wrote often on politics. His work has also appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The New Republic, the New York Review of Books, and many other publications. His book, Whittaker Chambers, a biography, won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize and was a finalist for both the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize. His latest book is The Death of Conservatism, A Movement and Its Consequences. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sam Tannenhaus.
Hey, good to be back on with you.
And Sam, there's a very provocative piece by David Brooks that appeared a few days ago that's got people chattering. It's almost like a blueprint for the Democrats to whip the Republicans. And he calls it, actually, the kill the wounded strategy. So it's a very odd to have a conservative giving the Democrats a blueprint how to destroy the this already fratricidal party. Do you think that the president's second term is going to be rewarded by this growing fratricide between within the conservative movement, between what David Brooks calls the Tea Party talk radio base of the Republican Party and its less ideological corporate and managerial class?
Well, I think so. I mean, it's been going on for a long time, and I think the real, confirmation, the wake-up call for the party, especially the people at the top of the party and in the conservative movement who are aligned with it. You know, the people like David Brooks, who's not so much a movement type as some others, but who is has a history in it, is, this last election. I think many on the right, Irving Kristol and Charles Krauthammer and people like that you'd see on Fox Television and Karl Rove and others really had persuaded themselves that they were going to win this election. They could not imagine how Obama would win. And I think what surprised them was not only the size of the victory and its sweep, which although, you know, it's not a landslide, but remember, this is, many people have said this is the first Democratic president since Franklin Roosevelt to win two successive terms with more than 50% of the vote. This is the first president in either party since Reagan to do that. I mean, this is a more successful president in terms of his popularity than any president since Reagan. That's why another New York Times op-ed columnist said Obama is the liberal Reagan. He has that kind of command and support. The numbers aren't as huge, and this gets to part of what we're talking about, because what we're really going through is a demographic change in the country that hasn't reached fruition. So there's enough of an opposition base, which is essentially a white male gerontocracy, to stop Obama a little bit. And that's what we see in the House of Representatives and such. So they can still obstruct him fairly well. What he has is about as close to a mandate as a recent president has had. One area where I would quarrel a little bit with David, whom I so often agree with and always respect, is he describes a lot of the issues coming up, gun control, immigration, as wedge issues meant to divide the Republican Party. Well, they're a lot bigger than that. I mean, these are the issues that matter to a lot of Americans. So Obama's success in getting some kind of legislation through an amnesty program or reform of immigration, some kind of limitation on this absurd and terrifying gun violence, those aren't just defeats for the Republican Party. And that's progress for the country. And it's important to see them that way, too.
But Sam Tannenhaus, it's a bit ironic, though, to think that what Karl Rove thought was a winning strategy to use these very same wedge issues to rile up his base and to roll over the Democrats. Now David Brooks is saying, telling the Democrats they should be using these same issues against the Republicans.
That's the big surprise, Ian, is that the culture wars, which were so successful and profitable for the Republican Party, really for a 20-year period from 1968 through 1988, when they won election after election, with the exception of a near win even after Watergate, those cultural issues have now turned against them. same-sex marriage, immigration, ideas about race and gender and ethnicity, abortion, contraception. These issues are now the third rail for the Republican Party. And for a long time, they feasted on those. And what happened was, it was interesting in the last election, Romney, who was, you know, more or less a disciplined candidate, time and time again would insist that the election was only about the economy. As soon as he was caught off guard, what does he start talking about? Minorities and women and students and all the gifts that are lavished on them, the 47% of the unproductive moocher class and all the rest. These became such mainstays of conservative ideology that they can't get past them even now. And so what happened was, that's why I mentioned demographics before. You know, even a few weeks, you may remember, before the election, big publications, Washington Post for one, ran the article we get used to seeing every 4 years, which is, why can't Democratic nominees do better with the white working class? How can they possibly win if they get only 40 to 40% of the vote? Well, Obama got even less than that, and it didn't make any difference. That is a minority now. That's what they still haven't wrapped their minds around, that their party is a shrinking, dwindling one. And this is what I wrote in the book you mentioned, you know, a few years ago, that this movement has really ended. It's reached its end point, and they don't know what's next. And so Obama, if he's smart, and the Democrats, if they're smart, will seize the advantage to push through the legislation that most of the country seems to favor anyway. They'd be silly not to do it.
Again, I'm speaking with Sam Tenenhouse, the editor of the New York Times Book Review and a former editor of the Week in Review section of the Times. His latest book is The Death of Conservatism, A Movement and Its Consequences. But there is a difference between the parties in terms of their combativeness and their resolve, if you will. When George W. Bush essentially got elected by the Supreme Court, he wasn't in any way embarrassed by his lack of a mandate. He charged ahead as though he had a mandate. And then, of course, after 9/11, he used that in many ways to push through a very aggressive agenda for which he was not elected. So compare that to this president that you just described as having been the first president since Reagan to have won over 50% in two successive elections. He has a real mandate, but he's never acted like he did in the first term. And do you think he's going to be more assertive in this second term?
Well, he seems to be so far. He drew the line on this upcoming debt ceiling battle. I mean, he just pushed it to the margins. He said he would not compromise. They backed down. He is, I'm told, by journalists who've talked to him very recently in interviews that haven't been published yet, much more partisan than he used to be. And he was during the campaign, too. You'll remember after he won in an early press conference, it was when Susan Rice was brought up, when that nomination was first floated. He was very direct about saying he'd won this election, and also when it came to negotiating over the Bush taxes, he said he reminded the Republicans he had run on this and would stand by it. And yeah, he gave a little bit of ground, but he got a lot more than he gave up. That's why, you know, the Republican House group, you know, almost just kind of fell apart at that point, and then finally had to push through what was essentially his proposal. So I think, you know, his nature seems to be conciliatory, partly because he was a law professor, and to try to find areas of agreement. But I'm told he strikes a more partisan tone now, which is not unusual. If you look at second terms and also the campaigns that incumbents run, in preparation for those second term, they tend to be more rather than less polarizing, because once you've been in office for 4 years, you can't so much be the kind of all things to all people candidate, which Obama was the first time, and most candidates are the first time they're out when they're first nominees. But so I think we will see more of that. And I think he's also lost patience and now sees that because he was reelected, there's enormous confirmation in that. And I have a feeling he will be quite aggressive and not afraid to go after what seems to be a weakened party. And I think that's what Brooks is writing about. Charles Krauthammer had something about this, too, that was much more defensive, as he tends to be, about how Obama was kind of unfairly picking on this this weakened party, kind of a silly argument. I mean, he won an election, and Republicans have been extremely aggressive, as you say, for many, many years now. But I think that there also is a kind of anxiety among the Republicans. Bill Kristol is supposed to be putting together some sort of organization or, you know, a group that modeled, they say, on the old DLC, the Democratic Leadership Committee, that's going to try to moderate the Republicans. And National Review, the conservative journal, is organizing this massive summit next weekend, 3 days long. We're going to work through all the arguments and debates. They're just starting from scratch now. They now know what they never quite acknowledged in 2008 is that they're beaten. And so Obama may not even have to push all that hard. People like Paul Ryan are already kind of maneuvering. Marco Rubio, Jindal, the ones who think they have a future in national politics are already moving away from the Tea Party group. He may not have to push all that hard. There'll be the one group in the House that will resist, mainly from the South, some from some of the kind of, you know, libertarian mountain states and such. But for the rest, I don't think they're going to give him a whole lot of trouble.
Right. And Chris Christie, of course, has already moved way to the left of the party.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, he jumped ship early on.
Right.
Yeah.
But you don't think then that this is a sort of repudiation of Karl Rove's strategy of creating this gerrymandered majority that he's got, you know, because one of the disturbing statistics of the last election was that the Democrats in the House got more votes than the Republicans did, yet the Republicans have considerably more seats. And those people that Rove engineered the election for, basically, they're more afraid of a primary challenge than they are of being out of step with the nation. So is that... I mean, it would seem to me that the real challenge Obama has is he's got to run in 2014 as though he ran in 2012. And normally in the midterms, a president doesn't take an active role. But it seems to me that this is the time for the Democrats to take advantage of disarray within the Republicans and really go for wiping them out in the House.
Well, I think you're right about 2014, though. That'll be difficult because of the districting and redistricting, the gerrymandering. Some of those seats will be very hard for Democrats to win. That's how they were set up. Also, of course, as you know, you get much lower voter turnout in the off-year elections, and that always helps the Republicans. You know, they tried to make it happen again in 2012 by, you know, through voter ID and all the rest. Yes, you're right. If the Democrats can make a strong surge, I mean, it's something like, 17 seats or something, which doesn't sound like all that many, except for the fact, as you say, that they're so tightly packed. These packed districts make it very hard to make any sort of inroad. But if they do make a really concerted effort, and if Obama has some successes, and also it'll be a question of where the economy goes. I mean, one reason the Republicans were so sure he would lose was because unemployment was so high. It didn't make any difference or made very little. If the economy actually starts to pick up in a noticeable way, Democrats could make some serious gains. But still, it will be really, really hard for them to do. I think you're quite right about Rove, by the way. I mean, that was the plan. You know, after 2000, which, as you rightly point out, the Democrats actually won. You know, Rove and company just made a point of getting more evangelicals out in 2004. You know, that's how they got their guy elected. So it's always been sort of, you know, working these particular bases they have. Those bases are not really there for the Republicans in national elections, but now they may be in congressional elections and also state elections. They still do pretty well, you know, in state houses and such. And because we have a more kind of balkanized culture, you know, state by state and also nationally. So those majorities are going to be hard for even a popular Democratic president to get until we've passed through the next phase of this demographic shift, I think, where there are more and more Latinos voting, a larger Asian population, where if the Republicans continue to be really extremist on the social issues, drive more and more women away, they're going to have to, you know, majorities will get built out of different blocks now. And so it may take another cycle or two before the Democrats really get there.
Well, just in the last minute, Sam Tenenhaus, up until 2014, how is the president going to govern? Can he keep this coalition that he found to get around this fiscal cliff impasse? In other words, push bills through the Democratic-controlled Senate to the House and get the House to do an up or down vote, because there's with the Democrats and enough wavering Republicans, he can get bills passed. Otherwise, it's gridlock.
Yeah, and it's going to be issue by issue, I think. You know, I mean, I think he does have these, you know, these signing laws, which I don't like. I think most people who are, you know, still invest some kind of authority in the Constitution don't love it, though presidents have been doing it more and more. And if that's what he has to do with a gun law, that's what he will do. Apart from that, I think it will be issue by issue. I think David Brooks is right, that immigration is going to be a lot tougher than he thinks. There will be real resistance to that in the Republican base. And David, I think, is right that Obama can demonize a lot of that vote, a lot of that support, but you're still going to have a big enough group that's going to make it hard for many Republican legislators. So I think it will go issue by issue. Healthcare is done. That's there. And by the way, you know, some credit on that, I think, goes to Roberts. I think that was the beginning of the shift in this last election cycle, was when Roberts took that issue away from them, which is also a sign that he, who is smart, after all, and has a sense of history, knew how out of line it all gotten. That if you have a massive piece of public legislation that makes it through both houses, and the opposition, however intense, is not an overwhelming majority, there's just no reason on earth to overturn it. So he had to let that go through. And so if Obama is clever, and he seems to have learned a lot,
right,
I think he'll be strategic with each of these issues one by one. And see where the majorities are.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Sam Tenenhaus.
My
I appreciate it. Again,
all
I've
right,
been speaking. Bye bye. Again, I've been speaking with Sam Tenenhaus, the editor of the New York Times Book Review and former editor of the Week in Review section of the Times. His latest book is "The Death of Conservatism: A Movement and Its Consequences." This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.